This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk, and we have an author today, my favorite mystery author. Her name is Elizabeth George. She's won numerous awards and been on the New York Times so many times, the bestseller list that is, and her new book, I think it's the 18th in the Lindley series, is Just One Evil Act, and she's here to talk about it. Hello!
Hello, how are you?
Hi, I'm fine. You are just an extraordinary talent. You know, it's hard to even put into words how good you really are.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That's something that's nice to hear, especially, and nice to remember, especially in moments when I am struggling with plotting out a new book, which is exactly what I'm doing right now. So thanks very much.
First of all, there's a lot of Italian in this book, and that's very different from you. You know, you've never had a book with a lot of Italian before.
No, I never have, and I would hasten to add that somebody does not need to speak Italian or even understand Italian to read the book, because what I've tried to do all along throughout is to provide within the narrative an explanation of what's being said in the Italian without directly translating the Italian. So the reader gets the idea of exactly what it is that's been said.
Yeah.
And so what I wanted to do is to use it as the it's a flavor of the place where they were.
Right. And it's very important. I mean, when you read a book, you want to understand. I mean, my mind has to understand everything I read, or I get frustrated. You know, the reader gets so frustrated. The last book you wrote, Believing the Lie, which is even more extraordinary, that book is just unforgettable. And this one, when I started reading it, I thought, well, I don't know if I'm going to like this one as much. And then all of a sudden, I just got so caught up in this story, this wonderful, wonderful story. I thought, now, you know what? Every book of hers is going to be great. Just every one is going to be great. And it's so true. I've never read a bad book by you.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very nice. I do put a huge amount of work into them, and I've always wanted each book to be a leap ahead of the last book as far as style and technique go. So
must be hard to do.
Well, you know, yeah, it is, but I'm really committed to that. I think we've all read writers who either wrote their best book first, and then everything after that has been sort of sad, and just, or either that or just not up to the standards of that first book. And I think we've all read books by people who are essentially just telling the same story over and over and over again.
Right.
Because they really have no other story to tell, and it's sort of one basic plot where they just change the names to protect the innocent.
Well, it's like the same thing happens with movies. The character, a movie makes a lot of money, so they make five other movies with the same characters, and it's like, already enough already. We know enough about these characters. There's nothing new in each one. It's all the same character over and over again. I mean, it's just there's nothing new. But with your books, everything is new. I mean, every time we read one of your books, there's something new going on. You're just extraordinary in that. The fact that you can tell a story and make it as interesting as it is in this book, and poor Haver, she's just going through the ringer in this one. I mean, this is like really give poor. I feel sorry for this poor woman.
Well, plus she does misbehave so dreadfully in this book. You know, given the opportunity to hang herself, she goes out and buys the rope. Part of what's going on, of course, is that Barbara is desperate to become involved in the case at hand in Italy because she knows the principals involved. And one of the fun things about Just One Evil Act, for me, the writer, and I think for a lot of readers, is that it actually begins about 30 minutes before the book ahead of it, Believing the Lie, before that book ends. So when the reader is, if somebody's read Believing the Lie, and of course it's not necessary to read it to understand what everything that's going on in Just One Evil Act, but for those who've read Believing the Lie, it's sort of a fun position that they are put in, because when it opens, all of a sudden, they begin to see, oh, wait a minute, the last book ended with Barbara trying to call Lindley on the phone and not being able to get through, and now we're with Lindley when he receives the phone call. So that was sort of a special thing that I did to give the just an acknowledgement to my longtime readers.
I mean, it just amazes me the amount of talent you really have and what you do with it. I mean, what your books are like. And this is a long book. It's over 700 pages. But I get so caught up in the book. I mean, it was like, I just want to know what's going to happen next. And you, the way the characters interact is just extraordinary. I mean, you have all this stuff going on with the different characters, with Lindley and Havers, and they're struggling with their friendship, too. Everybody seems to be struggling with something in this book.
Well, and I think that that's what makes the book very, very readable despite its length, is that essentially it's a book about character. And most human beings are interested in other human beings as they're revealed through, you know, through their struggles and trials, hence, you know, through their character. So because of that, because we are sort of like intimately involved with these people right into their heads from the get-go, That makes for a very quick read. And you're not the only person who said that. My God, this book is over 700 pages, and I read it just in a couple of days. And I was even surprised by that. I certainly didn't expect people to sit down and read it in 2 days, but I've had people tell me that.
I can still remember, and the joy that I've gotten out of reading some of your books. I remember the one about the violin. I can't remember the title of it.
Oh, that was A Traitor to Memory.
I can remember standing in my garden reading that book and just having the time of my life reading it. And that's a fact. I'm not just saying that. That's absolutely true. And I have moments like that where I remember books that I was reading and the joy I was getting out of reading it. And I've gotten so much joy out of your books, I don't even know how to express that.
Well, isn't that a wonderful experience, though? I myself love reading. I am always reading a book, and I can't imagine not having a book to read. You know, for me, one of the real nightmare would be going on a flight somewhere and not having a book to read, or finishing a book with like 4 hours left in the flight. That would just be horrible. But the beauty is when you find a book that you really get caught up in and swept away by, it's just it's sort of an unparalleled experience. I don't think there's anything like it, because it's a participatory activity. The writer is creating something, but the writer is asking the reader to imagine it. And what a wonderful experience that is, to be able to imagine the people, to imagine the place, to imagine their voices. It's just, I don't think there's anything like it.
It's interesting, though, because watching all the Lindleys on TV with Nathaniel Parker and Sharon Small, I mean, I envision them. Whenever I read the books, I envision that they look like that, but they don't really look like that. So it's kind of interesting how I have that in my mind, and yet that's really not how the characters are described in your mind.
I've stubbornly refused to change the description to match what Nathaniel and Sharon look like. P.D. James once said that Roy Marsden played Adam Dalgliesh, she stopped describing Adam Dalgliesh because she knew everybody would just picture Roy Marsden no matter what. And I thought, well, okay, but what the heck? You know, Lindley looks like my Lindley. You know, he looks the way I want him to, want him to look. And I wasn't going to change that just to match him up to something that's on television.
What was your experience like when you first saw the first episode of that series? I'm wondering what was it like to watch that for you?
Well, I would say, first of all, visually, it was a very different experience, because I pictured all of the locations far differently, and of course all the individuals far differently. But because I had gone to an actual location to set the novel in, a village called Lastingham in England, that was the place that I really envisioned when I was writing about Telldale. What was interesting for me is that they did go to the exact abbey that I called Telltale Abbey, which is actually called Gervaux Abbey, and they filmed there. And they also filmed in the exact same hotel that I had used for where St. James and Deborah stayed, and where Lindley and Havers go to dinner that night in A Great Deliverance. So that was pretty fun to see that. But it was sort of an odd experience seeing the rest of it, you know, realizing, oh, okay, well, I didn't really picture it quite like that. But it was still fun for me, because I knew that it was extremely important for me to separate the cinematic Great Deliverance from the book A Great Deliverance, because I knew that they would be quite different. So it was intriguing, and of course very, very gratifying to have one's book come to the small screen, especially through the means of the of British filmmakers.
I'm thinking, even as you're saying all this, about the psychology of your books, all the psychology with the characters, and how fascinating it is. And I think you have a degree in psychology, don't you?
Well, I have a degree in my master's degree is in counseling psychology. Yeah, so I do have that. And you know, my whole life I've found human psychopathology really, really interesting. And that goes from my earliest childhood when I was able to read the newspaper. I always gravitated, as a young child, to the stories that, you know, sort of revealed human psychopathology in action. And long have I found that really fascinating. So it was sort of a natural way for me to go, both in my education and as a writer as well.
Are you as successful as you want to be right now?
Well, I don't think anybody is ever as successful as they want to be, with the exception of J.K. Rowling.
Yes.
I never had success in terms of copious amounts of money in my sight. I would love to have more readers and love to continue to build a readership. And that is, you know, that's the, to me, is the most important thing, because, you know, when you write a book, you are sharing something with other people, and you know, John Steinbeck talked about the trinity that's involved among the writer, the readers, and the book, and that you need to have all three of those for the trinity to be complete. I love how he goes on and says, but critics have no part in this, which I find really cool, and then he does a riff on critics, but my objective would be ever to enlarge the trinity so that I bring on board more and more readers. And you know, it was, and I still continue to build readership. I'm always kind of surprised to find somebody who's read absolutely none of my books, but I shouldn't be, because there are a billion books out there to be read, so, you know, why should mine be something that...
I feel sorry for anybody who hasn't read your books. That's what I feel sorry for.
That's so kind of you.
But they're an experience that I can't even begin to tell people what they've meant to me over the years. I mean, the comfort they've brought, the fun that I've had reading them, the joy of sitting in the sun reading this book, and
well,
this book and that book.
Well, you know, a lot of people have told me that. A lot of people have told me that, you know, people have come to book signings and have said, your books got me through my cancer treatment. Or your books got me through the loss of my spouse, or my divorce, or things like that. So I have had that, and I think it's because the books tell a huge story. Each book, of course, is a crime novel, and it is a complete story of this particular crime and its impact on the people that surround the victim, the people that surround the killer, and the people that surround the police. But there's also the huge story arc of these continuing characters and what they're going through in their lives. So it's not as if the reader just reads, you know, one good book and then has to go out searching for another good book, because if the reader likes these characters, and invariably there is a character among the group of continuing characters that an individual will like, then they know that, well, if I get the next book, I can enter into this person's life yet again. And I think that it's that experience that's provided for people that puts them in this position of saying, oh, you know, I'm so grateful that these books existed, that I could, you know, I could read it and really become involved in something.
There's two major shockers to me in this book, and one of them, you know, is who's behind everything, but there's another major shocker that comes at the end of the book that I totally didn't expect, and it's interesting when that happens, but the problem with interviewing authors is you can't ask them about it, because then you get...
Well, let me tell you something that I think that you'll probably find really fascinating, and it won't really give away anything, and I think maybe your listeners, readers, will enjoy as well. And that is that I had my means of murder in the book fairly early on, and there were several people who participated in finessing that, including a really wonderful woman at University of Michigan. But my biggest difficulty was, how the hell was the killer going to put hands on what is used?
Right.
Now, this is, honest to God, this is what happened. I was in Italy, actually taking a language course at Scuola Michelangelo in Florence, and on the weekend, I would go out to another location by train. So I was going to Padua by train, and I sat down next to an older gentleman who said hello to me, and he spoke English and turned out to be English. And in that way that you occasionally have of getting into conversations with people that are sitting next to you, he and I began to talk, and it turned out that his business was exactly what I needed to get my...
Oh, that's extraordinary.
It was the most incredible. When he told me, I just looked at him and I said, let me ask you a few questions.
Oh, my... It's like God dropped him out of the sky for you, you know?
Yes. It was absolutely incredible. It was just amazing. And I just said, oh, my God, that is it. Thank you. And then we went our separate ways at the end of the train ride.
What if you'd never met him? This book may not have come into existence.
Well, I would have come up with another means.
Yeah.
I had suggested for myself in my notes several other ways for this to fall into the hands of the individual who uses it. But nothing was as good as this particular thing.
Now, I should mention the book is out from Dutton. I don't think I mentioned your publisher, but how in the world, and what kind of time element is there to writing a 700-page book? I mean, this must have taken you at least a year and a half to write.
I think from the time I left, usually the time is pretty much the same. From the time I go to wherever I'm going to go to do research to the time it is put to bed with all the revisions done and everything at Dutton, it is about 18 months, which is pretty fast for a book that's over 700 pages.
Meanwhile, Nora Roberts has four books coming.
I know, well, yes, but not quite as long.
No, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. That woman's extraordinary. I think she's some kind of computer or something, you know. She keeps putting them out. And nothing against Nora. A lot of people love her books. I haven't read any of them, so I can't really say. I think I read one of the in-depth books, but...
Well, Ruth Rendell is also very, very prolific. I call Ruth Rendell La Machine because, I mean, I think she puts out two books a year. At least at her height, she was putting out two books a year. And they actually had to give her another name, Barbara Vine, because she started writing books that were not her Inspector Wexford books. They were totally different, and actually I preferred them to her Inspector Wexford books. But they were just, you know, she was writing so many that that was the solution that they came up with.
Now, do you have an author like I feel about you that it's just extraordinary, that you think is one of the most extraordinary authors?
I definitely would really pop. The person who pops to my mind immediately is John Le Carré. He has grown so tremendously as a writer over the 40-plus years of his career. When you think of what he started out with A Small Town in Germany and A Murder of Quality, and then compare it to a later book like A Perfect Spy, which I think is his masterpiece, or The Constant Gardener, which was unforgettable. You know, he has really, really grown tremendously. And whenever I see one of his books out in hardbound, I buy it immediately without question.
Interesting. I never would have expected you to say John Le Carré. I don't know. I mean, you always have this idea in your mind. I wonder who she's going to say. Maybe she's going to say, you know, all these mystery authors. Immediately I think of mystery authors because you're a mystery author yourself, and I think, well, she probably loves mystery authors, but it's not always the case.
No, and I don't read a great many of them, first of all, because that's what I'm doing all the time is writing crime novels, but I read very, very eclectically, and I've started keeping a list of my 10 best, that I'm calling it, you know, that I'm going to actually... Probably post on my website for people who are interested in Christmas book buying. So I just decided to do that this year. And when I look at those books, I think one of them might be a crime novel. I can't really recall, but the rest of them are very, very, they really run the gamut. But some of them are also nonfiction.
Yeah, it's amazing, and it's always, I love to see what authors' favorite. I mean, when they have those books on their sites, what they're going to pick, and some of them just really surprise me. And some of them I've read and haven't liked, and I think, oh my God, maybe I missed something. Isn't that?
But it's such a reading is such an individual experience. That's
it is.
For example, I just one of my friends gave me a book recently that really actually was very very well reviewed. But she loves history. It's the new book called The Plantagenets.
Oh.
And she loves history. As a matter of fact, she very rarely reads fiction. And so she was rhapsodizing about the book, and I said, I want to read it. And she lent it to me. And I got about halfway through. And then I just said, you know what? I can't do it. And the reason that I couldn't do it has to do with something that was said in a book by Christina Baldwin called Story Catcher. And it's a nonfiction book about writing. And she said that history is, I'm going to really paraphrase it. History mm-hmm. comprises the facts compiled by scholars and conquerors. Story is what it was like to live on the ground. And to me, as soon as I read that, I realized that was it. That was why I could not bear this book. That what it was for me as a reader was a recitation of facts. And as I was going through one Plantagenet king to the next, a number of the facts were facts that I recognized from novels that I had read that were the story of these exact same situations that were being described just listed in this book, The Plantagenets. So, it's sort of an odd experience that somebody reads a book and just says, man, this is wonderful, and other people, for example, for me, the best book ever written, I think, is Possession by A.S. Byatt. But I know people who couldn't stand that book. I loved it.
Yeah.
I was transported. And it had to do with what she managed to pull off as an artist. That it was the sheer breadth of what she did as a writer in that book was amazing. And I call it a novelist's novel. And yet her follow-up book, The Children's Hour, I couldn't finish.
Isn't that extraordinary?
I hated it.
That's one of the things about reading, though. Like you said, it's an individual experience. And it's not only individual to the person, but every book they read is individual. And it doesn't even matter if it's the same author. You could love one book and hate the next.
Exactly.
And why is that? I don't know. I mean, I remember when The Bridges of Madison County came out. I loved that book. I'm ashamed to admit it to my male friends think I'm gay for even liking the book. But, every other book that came out afterwards was terrible
mind. Yeah. Yeah,
And you wonder why that happens. Do you struggle with every book as far as writing and plot? And I mean, you said you were struggling with number 19. I know you're working on number 19 right now. But is it a struggle for every book to get it all together?
The tough part is the actual plotting of the book, because these books have to be plotted in such a way that the whole house of cards does not collapse. So you have to play out information very, very carefully. And it has to be played out so that the all the scenes in the novel are causally related, but at the same time, it has to be played out in such a way that the reader is positioned at the right part of the wave. If you consider the plot of the story a breaking wave,
mm-hmm.
you want the reader swimming as fast as he or she can to catch up to the wave. You don't want them to be in front of the wave
mm-hmm.
as it's breaking. So that means that as I write one of these books, I have to continually be in the mind of the reader. Like, what is the reader going to think if I put this scene here versus another scene here? The way crime novels, or especially my crime novels, are plotted, the way they're plotted is to assure that the reader thinks a certain thing at all times.
And what's interesting, I mean, these characters are going through so much, and I think to myself, maybe Barbara's really going to lose her job. I mean, this is just, maybe she's just going to be fired, and it's going to be a whole, as I read your books, I'm never quite sure what's going to happen. And that's the way it should be, where the reader does know. I mean, you can't know, it makes it more difficult to read a book when you know that nothing's going to happen to the major characters,
Exactly. And since, in With No One as Witness, since in that book one of the five major characters is murdered, that allows the reader to know that nobody is safe in these books. And because nobody is.
It's like The Walking Dead. I don't know if you watch The Walking Dead, but from week to week, you never know what character is going to be killed off.
Well, exactly. No, I don't watch that, but what I have watched is MI5.
Oh, MI5.
Yeah, and in MI5, they regularly killed off main characters. I mean, regularly. Killed them off, had them arrested, had them flee to South America, all kinds of things, and that was it. They were gone. And so that the first time it happened, I thought, holy moly, what's going on here? That's the star of the show. And
right.
Then I began to see how incredibly useful that was as a device, because that meant that when you were watching a scene of incredible tension, that didn't mean those guys were going to survive. So it's much, it's just really much better to have a willingness to jettison a character if it is part and parcel of the book that you're writing.
Now, obviously you're working on 19 now, so you know, how far in advance do you know what's going to happen to Lindley and Havers? I mean, do you know 3 books from now what's going to happen to them?
Well, at the end of Believing the Lie, for example, I knew that the next book had to deal with what had happened with regard to Hadia.
Mm-hmm.
Because having laid down that gauntlet, I certainly had to pick it up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And deal with it. So sometimes I do know what's going to happen. I would say that I know ultimately where I'm heading with all the characters. I don't know how long it's going to take me to get there. And because I begin each journey into novel writing by deciding upon what the crime is, and, you know, sort of the killer, the victim, and the motive, I don't know exactly how much of any one character's story I'm going to be able to put into that book. So, for example, in this book, I know where I want to go in the new book with both Lindley and Havers, but I don't know if I'll actually be able to get there. Because you can't, see, the thing is, you just can't force this kind of thing.
No, absolutely. Well, that's why you're a master.
Well, if you force, what happens is that it just clunks and groans along, and see, everything that happens has to be not seem, but be natural to the plot. It has to adhere to the rest of the plot. You have to have a unity of sort of a thematic unity. And I've done books where all of a sudden I realize, you know what, I'm not going to be able to do Haver's story in here. For example, in a book I wrote called Deception on His Mind, which was a big Haver
book. Oh, yeah, great book.
One of the things I wanted to do was to explore Haver's past in this particular part of Essex. But as I was doing it, it just didn't work. I could feel it didn't work.
Yeah.
And I'm a very visceral writer. I write by how it feels, because your brain is the place where the committee is, and the committee is going to tell you everything's rotten. So you never want to listen to the committee. I never listen to the committee. I do it all by how it feels. And I could tell in that book it just did not feel right. It was not unified with the rest of the story, so it had to go.
And, you know, what's interesting about your books is looking back on and thinking back on when I was reading them, I can still remember scenes in books. I can still remember the book where Lindley's wandering around. He's kind of in a daze because he's had that great loss. And, you know, he's wandering around the countryside and he finds that body. I mean, I can still see that in my head. Because you're so good at painting that picture of the books. I mean, when we read the books, you get that full picture, and it stays with you. And to me, that's the work of a great artist, somebody that when you read these books, you remember them even months and years later.
And that's wonderful. I so much appreciate that, because, of course, that's what I'm trying to do. You know, I have my own special memories of different scenes in the books. I love the scene in Playing for the Ashes, where Lindley is with a boy that has really the key to what happened to the murder victim, jumps in the Thames to get away from Lindley, and Lindley's been chasing him all around the Isle of Dogs, and that's what he ultimately does, is jumps in the Thames, and Lindley goes after him. And of course, it's a tidal river, and the tide's coming in, so it's very dangerous. And just as he jumps off, dives in, you've heard Barbara saying, don't do it, don't do it. And then you hear he hears, because it's in his point of view, he hears somebody yell Tommy, and that's the first time and only time Habers ever has ever called him by his first name. And that kind of moment, it was, to me as a writer, it's just, it really resonates, and I really remember that. But there are other moments in my own books that I don't remember at all that people might bring up, and I'll have to think, oh my God, did that really happen? And then look at the book and realize, oh yes, indeed it did.
I'm thinking to myself now about the almost the sexual tension there is between Lindley and Habers. I mean, I would assume you have some readers who write to you and say, when are you going to get them together? When are they going to get together?
Well, you know, I think the only people that think that are, and I have had people ask that, but I always say to them the same thing. I always say, I bet you've never read one of the books. I bet you've only seen the television show. And they reluctantly admit that that's the case. Because people who have read the books know that there is no way on earth these two characters would ever, ever have any kind of sexual relationship. They simply wouldn't. And I never wanted them to. I wanted to create characters that dealt with the idea that a man and woman could love each other in a completely non-sexual way.
And it's interesting because Lindley's very rich, and Habers is all but poor. I mean, she's not living. She doesn't make a lot of money. So they're totally different people, you know.
Well, plus the British class system is such that it would be extraordinary. It would be beyond extraordinary for someone of Lindley's birth and position to marry someone of Barbara's birth and position. I mean, we're not talking about Prince William marrying Kate Middleton.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, you know, that was, frankly, with Prince William marrying up, in my to my way of thinking, and not marrying down. But it's not. But there's a, you know, there's a huge divide between, you know, the Middletons as upper middle class people and the working class. I mean, huge divide. All you have to do is listen to open their mouths and say one sentence, and that's it. Everything's, you know, that's all she wrote. So it just wouldn't happen.
Have you ever gotten stuck on a book where you just couldn't think of what to do next, and it really did a number on you for a while?
Well, in my second book, I remember having dinner one night and saying to my husband, I have absolutely no idea what to do next. And he looked at me and said, kill somebody else.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that's
and
funny.
And I said, oh, you know what? I know I can do that, and I know who it's going to be. So it worked out. So yeah, I mean, I have had that kind of thing happen before.
Oh, that's so funny, though. I mean,
and Raymond Chandler said that too. He put it a different way, and he said, when you don't know what to do, bring in a man with a gun.
And you know, my mom used to say, she used to read Agatha Christie, and she'd say to me, there aren't enough murders in these books. She would say that to me, and I'd think, Mom, you want more murders? Why? But you think about it, a murder enhances how it becomes more interesting when there's another murder.
Well, yeah, definitely. It ups the stakes, that's for sure.
I mean, you look at it, and then there were none. The fact that everybody's being picked off one
oh,
by
yeah.
one.
Yeah,
I mean, by the time there's nobody left, and I'm like, nobody's the murderer because they're all dead.
Yeah, well, that is the extreme, isn't it? But then that was the whole point, because that's the one that they... In Britain, they called 10 Little Indians, I think.
Right, absolutely. It's a book that I remember reading, like, the first, 100 pages of it. It was the most boring book I'd ever read. And then all of a sudden, they get to the island, and it's like, oh, my God, this is extraordinary, you know?
Yeah, you don't want to go to an island in an Agatha Christie novel.
Because you never leave. You know?
Someone's going to die.
When do you pick the titles of your book? Do you wait until they're fully done before you pick a title, or do you have the idea of the title in your mind?
You know what? It just depends. For Just One Evil Act, it was probably midway through that I realized what the title ought to be, because essentially that's what's in one character's mind is, let me do just this one little evil thing. And then, of course, it snowballs out of control. But sometimes I have it in from the beginning. The book I'm working on right now, I had the title before I started writing it. And it's called The Banquet of Consequences. And I got the title from my fellow writer, Nancy Horan, who wrote the book Loving Frank. And she and I were having lunch one day, and I asked her about her new novel that she was working on. And if she had a title, and she said, well, I really wanted to call it A Banquet of Consequences. and because that was a line attributed to Robert Louis Stevenson, and her new book is about Robert Louis Stevenson. And I said, oh, my God, that is such a great title. And she said, well, yeah, the problem is it doesn't really relate to the book. And I said, well, if you don't use it, may I use it? And she said, yeah. And so a few months later, she told me the title that her publisher wanted to use for the book, which was from another Robert Louis Stevenson quote, Under the Wide and Starry Skies. And they felt that that was more appropriate considering the scope of the novel. And I said, does that mean A Banquet of Consequences is mine? And she said, it sure does.
Is that right? So yeah. that's really going to be the next title.
Yes, and it's perfect for the novel. As soon as she said it, I knew, because I knew what the book was going to be about, this novel. I was in the unusual position for the novel I'm working on right now to know for quite some time what the story that I wanted to tell.
But if you keep talking to people, you're going to get ideas forever.
Well, you know, one thing I've found, though, that is so helpful for me as a writer is that when I'm with other people, I very rarely talk about myself. I mean, you and I are conducting an interview.
Right.
Oops, excuse me, that's my dog.
The
interview is about, you know, it's about me. But in another situation, like a social situation, I really don't talk about myself. So that puts me in a position of learning vast amounts about other people.
Aren't a lot of writers shy to begin with anyway?
A lot of writers are introverts. I wouldn't say so much that they're shy, but to be able to, you know, when you think about it, write for hours and hours a day by yourself, it really does require you to be the kind of person who prefers to be alone. And that's the kind of person that I am. I've always pretty much been a hermit. So when I'm with other people, what I've learned to do sort of as a coping device, because I don't like large crowds, and I don't like parties and things like that. So what I've found is that it's much more interesting and essentially beneficial to me to learn about them.
Now, I have to ask you about these children's books, which I haven't read yet, The Edge of Nowhere, and I think the new one's called Edge of the Water.
Uh-huh.
That's coming out in March. What are those all about? One of the girls has an extraordinary talent.
Yeah. The Edge of Nowhere, it's a series of books that are set on Whidbey Island here in Washington, where I live. And they center around one particular girl and four other young people. So they're young adult novels, not necessarily children's novels. Well, actually, they're not children's
novels.
What
got you to write those? I mean, when do you get the time to do it?
Well, I wanted to do it because I wanted to see, first of all, if I could use a place that I lived as a setting, and I just had the idea for this group of kids that I wanted to write about along the lines of books like, well, I don't even know, there's really no comparison, there probably is, but I probably just don't know what it is. I wanted to write books that were not dystopian universes or books that had, witches, warlocks, wizards, vampires, or anything like that. I didn't want to write about a world in which kids existed by themselves. So that was my jumping off point, was to try to write a series that was intriguing to young readers but was more realistic, so that it would have kids who interact with adults all the time just the way normal kids actually do.
Yeah, no, I'm sure they're terrific. I can't wait to read the first one. I think I have the first one. I just haven't gotten to it yet. The problem with me is I'm so used to Lindley that to read something else that you've written is a shock. I have to get used to it, you know, and that sounds weird.
But I think you probably will enjoy it. See, what it is is that the one character is, her name is Becca, and the story opens with Becca and her mother on the run from her stepfather for reasons that become apparent over time.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And what we learn in very short order is that Becca possesses a really odd, I don't want to call it a talent, I'll say it's an ability, but it also serves as kind of a disability for her. And that is that that she can hear the broken-up thoughts of other people. And when I say broken-up thoughts, I mean it's like a badly tuned radio. So when she's with another person, if she's not wearing a device that was created for her so that she could just cope in school, she hears this plethora of language coming at her. Her journey is to learn how to control that, which when the book opens, she she can't, and the only person who could teach her how to do that is her grandmother, who has died.
So what kind of reaction did you get to the first book? I'm curious.
As far as I know, the people who have read it and who have communicated with me have liked it very much. And young people have liked it as well as adults.
Now, is there a planned number of books in this series? It looks like everyone's going to be called Edge.
Yes, the third one is, I've written the third one, and it's called The Edge of the Shadows. My guess is that it will take me 6 books to accomplish.
So many trilogies in children's literature now. Everything's a trilogy, and it's like
this should be 6. There's no way I could do it in 3. So I've already done the third, and it's not anywhere near the conclusion.
You always write big. Everything that you write, it takes a long time to tell the story, which is wonderful. I love that. I mean, but it's interesting how these books are about 400 pages, over 400 pages.
Yeah, they're about in the 400-page range, yeah.
It's funny because you look at a lot of children's books and, you have picture books which are 30 pages long, and then you have these. Now they have, the big thing is the stories, The Hunger Games is so much longer, and it's so much, but the kids just love them. I mean, and what age are they for?
These books go from, I think the youngest person that I know of that's read it was 10, and the oldest person was probably 90.
Right.
I think it was my neighbor who was 94. Adults read them. They're written for young people in that young people are all the point of view characters. But I think the story is good enough to be carried right into adults' interest as well.
So can we expect one of those books a year?
Probably more like 18 months.
18 months. And when do you think we'll see the next Linley one?
The next Linley one will probably come out, I would say, spring or summer of 2015.
Oh, my God. I can't even wait that long. I'm going to be in withdrawal. You realize what that's going to do to me.
You could read them all over again.
To say you're an extraordinary talent seems to be underestimating it, because you really are. And I don't say that lightly. There are not a lot of authors that I would say that about. But you are.
I very much appreciate that. Most of the time, believe me, I don't feel that way at all.
Well, you should feel that way, because you are. This has been extraordinary, as always. And we'll have to talk sometime about the kids' books in more detail when that one comes out. So you're just a wonderful lady, and I know you love your dogs, and you're into gardening, too, aren't you?
I am, yes. I definitely am. I'm in the middle of winterizing my cutting garden right now. It's taking me days upon days upon days to do it.
So you love to be out. And you love to travel, too.
Yeah, I do. I do, especially to Italy, because after 8 years of studying Italian, I can finally order a meal.
What do you have left that you haven't done that you'd like? I mean, do you have other ideas for books or things that are coming up that you just can't talk about?
No, not really. I think my objective is to try to live one day at a time and stay present, which is, obviates the necessity for making a great deal of plans. But other than that, no.
Well, we have to let you get back to your writing, or you'll never get the book done. So, Elizabeth, this has been extraordinary, and I can't thank you enough.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's good talking to you, David.
Okay. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.